Before we hear this week's clip from George Monbiot, title of which is George Monbiot Breaks Down Why We Need to Destroy Farming. That's the actual title of the video. Of course, farming is something that we need in order to healthily feed us, and people who are in charge of farming at the moment mostly are small farmers who are under threat. The idea is to remove families and replace them with corporations, which George seems to want to do, and businesses, which are manufacturing food in factories rather than growing it in the earth. And he is here, he's also implying genetic engineering of crops, which he was very much against when I knew him. Before we hear that, I'd just like to give you a quote from 1972 from somebody called Saul Alinsky. Saul, S-A-U-L-A-L-I-N-S-K-Y, in his pamphlet Rules for Radicals from 1972. Accuse your opponent of what you are doing to create confusion and inoculate yourself from guilt in the eyes of the voter. Now, George is a Guardian column and he's supposedly an environmentalist who supports nuclear power. And, of course, nuclear power is intertwined with the nuclear weapons business. Scientific knowledge is intertwined with the nuclear weapons business, and also nuclear power is not environmental. The nuclear waste persists for tens or even hundreds of thousands of years and is extremely unenvironmental, but George is in favour of nuclear power. Just to let you know that he calls himself an environmentalist that wants to destroy farming and is in favour of nuclear power. I worked with George back in 1995, 1996, 1997 in Oxford. A very nice chap at the time, but then suddenly Chernobyl happened. And then it was Fukushima. And at the time of that disaster, there was lots and lots of calls. And in fact, the Germans did shut down their nuclear industry. But suddenly George decided he was going to use his column in The Guardian to change his mind all about nuclear and why it was now suddenly wonderful. So I'll leave you to have a listen to George Monbiot, see if he makes any sense to you, and see if you think he's an environmentalist by trying to rid the land of family farmers and to replace food production with factory food production.
Let's start with the environment. What do you see as the biggest threat to our environment and ecology in the modern world?
So to start off, I don't call it the environment, because that is a word which conjures no pictures in the mind at all. It's like some weird thing out there. Mm. Whereas actually what we're talking about is everything that sustains us, is the whole earth system that is our life support system. It's everything that is important to us is what we talk about when we use this weird detached word, the environment. So what we're looking at here is a whole series of interlocking, amazing systems, ecosystems, oceans, atmosphere, the cryosphere, which means the world's ice and snow, the ocean currents, the air currents, all of these things working together to sustain the habitable space that we call the living planet. Mm. And when those things break down, then the whole lot goes. Basically, if one element of that collapses, it causes a domino effect going bing, 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 knocking down all Earth systems effectively. This is what's happened in previous mass extinctions. That's what we call a mass extinction, is basically when Earth systems collapse. You know, what we see in the geological record is individual species disappearing, and we say, oh yeah, it's sad that the species are gone. No, the whole lot came crashing down. And the one which is most analogous to our situation today is what happened 251 million years ago. Most of your audience won't remember it. It was at the end of the Permian period and the beginning of the Triassic period. And what happened was basically a mass fossil fuel burning event. And it was caused by magma, molten rock, being squeezed through sedimentary rocks in the area that's now Siberia. And those sedimentary rocks were full of coal and other hydrocarbons, which got burnt as this hot magma was pushed through it. And it caused eventually between 8 and 10 degrees of global heating. But it seems that the main pulse of the mass extinction happened at between 3 and 5 degrees of heating. And that wiped out combined with toxic gases from the volcanism, acid rain, about 90% of species on Earth, including all or almost all the large and medium-sized vertebrates, animals with backbones, the fish, the reptiles. Today, that obviously would include us. And you can see the rocks. There's a few places where you can see cliffs where this happens, and it's like fossils, 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 and then nothing. Just red desert for millions of years. It took about 5 million years for any significant amount of plants to come back on Earth. It took 7 million years before enough plants were growing to start laying down coal. And it took probably about 50 million years before biodiversity recovered. Now, that mass extinction took place across several thousand years. That's how long it took to get to 3 or 5 degrees of global heating. We are doing all that in a few decades. So our chances of not triggering a mass extinction are actually very small. Our chances of not triggering Earth systems collapse are actually very small if we continue on the current trajectory. And in order to avoid that permo-triassic cataclysm happening again 251 million years later, we have to change everything. We have to leave fossil fuels in the ground. That's number one. But right up there, number two or equal number one, stop farming animals. That is up there with fossil fuels as being one of the two greatest drivers of extinction and Earth systems collapse. If you do that, those two things together, leave fossil fuels in the ground, stop farming animals, you've probably solved about 95% of the problem. There's still other issues like synthetic chemicals, which urgently need to be dealt with. But those come in at number one and number two. Fix that, and we've got a very high chance of averting mass extinction. Don't fix either of those issues, we've got almost no chance at all.
It's really interesting to hear that equivalence between the animal husbandry and burning of fossil fuels, because I think traditionally people sort of talk, when people talk about man-made climate change, they think of planes flying yeah. through the sky. I don't think anyone necessarily thinks of a dairy farm.
No, well, we are just so far behind on that issue. I mean, it took long enough to get people aware of what fossil fuels were doing to the planet. Yeah, I mean, I fought those brutal battles 25, 30 years ago, fighting climate deniers all the time, supporting the science against people who were saying, no, carbon dioxide is good for the planet, it's plant food, we all want to live in a warmer place, and all of this nonsense, you know, which was just pumped out there by huge fossil fuel-backed campaigns. They poured tens of millions of dollars into these campaigns to persuade us that what they were doing was harmless. Now we're seeing exactly the same with the livestock industry. Mm-hmm. And it's got a whole new range of attack angles, of greenwashing, to try to persuade us that there's nothing wrong with killing 76 billion animals a year to feed ourselves and the massive range of environmental damage required to do so. And it's largely because of animal agriculture that farming is the worst thing we've ever done to the planet. It's the number one cause of habitat destruction, the number one cause of deforestation this century, the number one cause of wildlife loss, number one cause of species extinction, number one cause of soil degradation, number one cause of water use, most importantly, the number one cause of land use. This is the great issue which is constantly neglected by environmentalists, the amount of land we use. And animal farming uses more land than all other human activities put together, about twice as much land as all other human activities. It's quite extraordinary, and yet we just blot it out of our consciousness. It's also one of the top causes of greenhouse gas pollution. In fact, animal farming alone, let alone the rest of farming, but just animal farming, produces more greenhouse gases than all global transport. And it's a major cause of water pollution and air pollution. You know, with water pollution, we talk in this country about the sewage being pumped in by the water companies, which is disgusting, revolting, but it's only the second cause of pollution in this country. The number one cause of pollution is agriculture, mostly livestock, primarily dairy farms and chicken farms, which are just pumping out so much shit into the catchment that even if they aren't dumping it directly into the river, which some are, it flows off the land into the river and has the same effect.
Gets washed off.
Yeah.
You you argue in your book Regenesis that we need to, well, maintain arable and arable farming and horticulture, but replace the livestock component with factory-produced protein sources. Why do you see that as the place to transition to? Why is that sort of that? Why should that become our source of protein?
Well, to start off with, we already get our protein from factories, and it's called animal farms, right? But we don't like to see it as a factory. But if you won't ever be allowed in. But if you were to go into one of the giant chicken sheds or giant pig sheds where the great majority of that meat and the eggs come from, or if you were to go into one of these huge new dairy farms where so much of our milk and dairy products is coming from, you would recognize that as a factory, a really vast, dirty, filthy, inefficient, cruel factory. In fact, almost everything we eat comes through a factory at least one point in its production. And if it's reared in one factory, it'll be slaughtered in another. Every single animal that ends up on our plate is slaughtered in a factory, a grotesque factory called an abattoir, right? Where you just don't want to know what's going on in there. People just blank it out. They deliberately turn away from it. In the United States, over 95% of people eat meat, and a survey found that 47% want to ban slaughterhouses. This is the extent of the denial that we're in as to where our food comes from. We just don't want to know. We don't want to know that we're killing 76 billion animals a year to feed ourselves. We don't want to know the cruelty that that involves. We don't want to know about the blood and the shit that that involves. We don't want to know about the massive environmental catastrophe that causes. So yes, I am calling for a different form of factory food production, in this case from microbes. Creatures which don't have nervous systems, which can't feel the pain, which aren't subjected to the cruelty that we subject animals to, and which can be produced with a tiny fraction of the land, the water, the fertilizer, in a contained environment so the pollution isn't poured out into the living world, and in ways which could help us greatly to restore the living planet, while at the same time ensure that people are better fed.
I wonder what your assessment of the sort of, you call it neo-peasant, but model of farming that basically says, well, agrees with your diagnosis of the problems that, you know, mass industrialized agriculture is ecologically disastrous, removes people from the food production chain, says, let's build a million small holdings across Britain. Let's combine, let's go for agroforestry. Let's replant woodland. Let's introduce large herbivores, similar to the way they have rewilded in Nep, for example. You know, there's potentially a model there to, you know, get large cattle, have these sort of decentralized, localized economies, return people to food production, deliver wholesome, beneficial work, provide them with housing, but still have access to, let's say, you know, meat as a food source. Why don't you see that as a viable solution to the problem?
Yeah, well, there's so many issues all muddled up into this bundle of neo-peasant farming, which is really an attempt to feed a 21st century population with a Neolithic production system. And that ain't going to work well. So if we look at NEP, for example, they produce 54 kilograms of meat per hectare per year. It's a tiny amount of meat. I mean, what they're doing is great. You know, it's a really lovely rewilding program. It's a really disastrous agricultural project if it were to be judged as an agricultural project, because that would mean that we could each have three small portions of meat per year if 10% of the whole country were turned into net and nothing else. That would be it. Yeah, we would starve very quickly indeed if that were our model. And of course, that's not how it would work out. People say, oh, well, we can all eat meat just very occasionally. Can you think of any other scarce luxury product where everybody has it, has an equal share of it? You know, does everybody have the occasional bit of bluefin tuna sushi or the occasional bit of beluga caviar? No, obviously not. Yeah, if the only way we produce meat was like that, it would be a super luxury product which only multimillionaires would eat. And they would eat it whenever they wanted, and we wouldn't eat it at all. right? That is the way it would shape out. So it's a total fantasy that we can sustain ourselves by those means. And people have confused, sometimes unwittingly, sometimes deliberately, this very, very low penetration, low density use of livestock as a conservation tool with livestock production. Mm. They are totally different things. It's like looking at a zoo and saying that's a natural ecosystem. These are entirely different scales on which it's being done. So you can't use one as a means of feeding people. It's just, that's not what it's designed for. It's not what it's capable of doing. And so there's this bucolic fantasy, this great romance about how we could produce our food, which is a formula both for global starvation and because of the enormous agricultural sprawl it would cause, the huge amount of land required to produce very little food, also a formula for mass environmental destruction. We could all eat pasture-fed meat, as the celebrity chefs and food writers tell us to, if we had several planets and no room for wild ecosystems on any of them. But because we don't, pasture-fed meat is the worst possible product. It's the most damaging of all food products. There was a study published in the United States looking at what would happen if people did what the foodies tell them to do and switch away from corn-fed beef, which is bad enough. I mean, that's a disaster in its own right. Switch from that to pasture-fed beef. And it found you would have to increase the area used for farming cattle by 270%. You'd have to cut down all the forests, water all the deserts, drain all the wetlands, degazette the national parks, demolish all the cities, and you'd still be importing much of your beef from Brazil. It's just people aren't doing the maths. This is a fundamental problem. You know, it took a long time with fossil fuels for people to start to do the maths. And there was this brilliant Do the Math tour across North America, persuading people to look at how much can we afford to burn? How much do we need to leave in the ground? And suddenly people started doing the numbers. We're not doing that with food at all. It's all pictures. It's pretty pictures. Look at this beautiful bucolic imagery. Look at these cows flicking their tails in the lush meadows. Look at this farmer with a stalk of corn sticking out of their mouth and a broad straw hat. It looks beautiful. It cannot feed the world. We have to do two things urgently. One is to feed the world and the other is to protect it, to protect the living planet while feeding its people. You can't do either of those things with this neo-peasant bullshit.
You see farmers as the collateral damage in that conversation. What you're saying there, feed the world, save the planet, destroy the farmers? Is that what follows?
No, well, I mean, the great majority of the farmers that we're talking about, you know, if you're talking about outdoor livestock farmers in a country like this, are totally dependent on farm subsidies.
Yeah.
If it weren't for our tax money, they would not be there. Mm. So I'm not saying they should leave the land and saying, let's continue to pay them, but to do something completely different, which is to restore the land rather than to keep destroying it. I mean, the trouble is when you're keeping stock on that land, livestock, at any even remotely commercial concentrations, so it's all loss-making. But, you know, if you're going to be supplying livestock for a market, they will be destroying almost everything on that land. They selectively browse out tree seedlings because those are highly nutritious, so trees can't grow. You want to fence out most of the wild herbivores. The reason we don't have large carnivores like wolves and lynx in this country is that the livestock farmers have resisted their reintroduction elsewhere in the world. They are the driving force behind the destruction of large carnivores. Everything except things which eat cow dung lose out from having those animals on the land. And so you cause massive environmental degradation to produce not very much food. Let's instead pay those farmers to restore those ecosystems. We'll concentrate farming in places where it makes sense. We should be switching to a largely plant-based and microbe-based diet, but certainly away from animal farming. We keep people on the land, but as genuine stewards and custodians of that land. The only way we're going to get through this century is with a mass global rewilding, the restoration of ecosystems on a vast scale, bringing back the forests, bringing back the savannas, bringing back the wetlands, the natural grasslands, the mangroves, the seafloor, the coral reefs, the kelp forests, all these wonderful ecosystems which we've been exterminating. Only by bringing them back can we stop the sixth great extinction in its tracks. Can we stop the collapse of our life support systems? Only by bringing them back can we draw down much of the carbon dioxide that we've released into the atmosphere. Because we now know that it's not enough merely to decarbonize our economies, which we need to do, obviously, as quickly as we possibly can. But at the same time, we've also got to attend to some of the carbon dioxide we've already released, because otherwise we're going to breach 1.5 degrees, probably 2 degrees of global heating. The only way to stay in that safe space is through allowing ecosystems, as they recover, to draw down that carbon dioxide and turn it into solid carbon. Wood, peat, mud, things like this are solid carbon. Coral reefs, oyster reefs, kelp forests, all of these are solid carbon, and they can turn that dangerous greenhouse gas back into living organisms.
Do you think there's nothing to be said for achieving that noble aim? If you democratize the process, create sort of, you know, individual people who are wardens of the land, shepherds of the land, stakeholders for their own little parcel of it, you can simultaneously support that kind of rewilding effort, potentially challenge or break the sort of supermarket oligopoly on food production. And if you instead shift food production towards, let's say, a factory type mechanism, or, well, not a shift, but a different kind, that's the point you've already made, that it becomes harder to achieve that kind of regeneration of the landscape.
Well, it's very hard to have a functioning ecology and an extractive industry going on the same piece of land. In almost all cases, they are at odds. I mean, there's some very low-level extractive industries which can survive alongside functioning ecosystems. There's very few of them on Earth, and they generally are only taking a very small amount out of it. But if we're going to be taking out enough to feed ourselves, then we're not going to be doing that alongside rich and functional ecosystems, which means above all having top predators in there. That's really crucial to allow an ecosystem to work. They are the regulators of the ecosystem. Wild herbivores, which can move freely in and out of it. Dense vegetation, particularly trees in places which formerly held trees. That's absolutely essential. Peat formation, where peat should be growing. That's also really, really important. All of these things are made much harder by trying to run an extractive industry in the same places. And basically, we should be concentrating production. You know, on land which is really good for producing crops, that's where we should be sustaining high yields. But on land which is really bad for producing crops and can only sustain livestock, which is devastating even when it produces relatively small amounts of food, we should basically be taking that out of production, turning it back to nature, allowing ecosystems to come back and producing our food by different means. And the different means are actually really exciting. You know, this isn't like, oh, well, we'll have to do it this way. This is like, oh, my God, we're opening an entire new food frontier here, a whole food revolution as profound as the invention of agriculture. You know, it's got this enormous potential, not just to substitute animal products, which is obviously the first thing it needs to do, but then to lead to the development of a whole new range of products, which we just can't even imagine at this stage, any more than the first farmers to capture a wild cow were thinking about Camembert.
So this is probably the nail in the coffin. I think you've kind of made your case, but regenerative farming, you think, is basically a non-viable solution to the problems we face?
Well, regenerative has become one of these words like sustainable, which is just tacked onto the front of whatever you're doing already. So regenerative ranching, formerly known as ranching. Now, in principle, I would love to see everything becoming genuinely regenerative, but the word has already been so polluted by greenwash that it's become almost useless, because everybody is saying what I'm doing is regenerative. What I've been doing for years is regenerative because I've called it regenerative. Now, a genuine agroecology, a genuine regenerative agriculture to produce our crops, our grain, our vegetables, our fruit, that would be a great thing as long as the yields are high. Because low yield farming means agricultural sprawl. It means you must use more land to produce a given amount of food. That's what extensive agriculture means. You know, people are constantly banging on about the evils of intensive farming, and intensive farming is doing a great deal of harm. And so they say we should pursue extensive farming as well. But that does a great deal of harm too, because of the amount of land it uses. The problem is not the adjective. It's the noun, right? So we have to pursue what I see as a holy grail in food production, which is high yields with low impacts. And one way of doing that for our protein-rich, fat-rich foods, which we're currently getting from livestock, is to do it by brewing. Instead of farming multicellular organisms, animals and plants, you farm unicellular organisms in a brewery with precision fermentation. It's just a refined form of brewing. But there are also some really exciting ways, new ways of growing our grain crops, of growing our fruit and vegetables, which do promise high yields with low impacts. One of the most exciting is perennial grain crops. Now, this is a dream which has been pursued by scientists for about a century, but it's finally coming to fruition, and in a very exciting way. In nature, large areas covered by annual plants, which means plants that live and die within 1 year, are pretty rare, and they generally occur in the wake of a disaster. So like a volcanic eruption or a landslide or a major fire, which kills all the long-lived plants, the perennial plants, the trees and the shrubs and the deep-rooted plants which last from 1 year to the next. And that's the opportunity for annual plants to move in. And annual plants, this is why we've cultivated them, they breed very fast, and they put a lot of effort into making seed, and they scatter that as wide as they can, occupy the ground for a year or two until the perennial plants come back and crowd them out. So in order to grow our annual grain crops, which means all our cereal crops like wheat and maize and barley, and our legumes like soy and lentils and chickpeas and all that, and our oil seeds like rapeseed and the rest, in order to do that, we have to create an environmental disaster every year. We have to clear the land. That's a terrible thing to do. Can you imagine? You're just destroying everything and making the land bare. We're so used to it that we celebrate it. You know, we think, oh, that's great. You know, look at that. Lovely. They're plowing the land. But that is to destroy the entire ecosystem. All the above ground life forms are being wiped out by plowing that land, or indeed by spraying that land to kill all the plants that might compete with your crops. And then having sown your grains, you have to pamper them, the baby plants, you know, so you have to give them loads of fertilizer. You have to kill off the competitors with herbicides. You have to kill off the insects and the other potential pests with pesticides. You might have to water them using our precious groundwater. And so you have to pamper and pamper these crops, bring them up to their maximum growth point. Then they produce the grain, then you harvest them, and then you start all over again. So what if we could produce our grain from crops which stay in the ground for several years at a time? You would massively reduce the amount of damage you're doing. And led by a group called the Land Institute in Kansas, but with various other research groups around the world, they've been looking across thousands of species for candidates which would make perennial grain crops, and they've found some. In fact, some of them look really promising, and one of them has already been fully commercialized, which is a perennial rice variety, which they got from crossing ordinary annual short grain rice with one of its wild relatives that's perennial. And they did this with Yunnan University in China, and now tens of thousands of hectares are growing this short grain rice. Farmers are desperate for the seed because it greatly reduces their costs. They don't need nearly so much ploughing and fertilizer and herbicide and all the rest of it. It also greatly reduces their need for labor, and a load of the young people have left the countryside and gone to the cities. And it causes much less soil erosion, which has become a really big problem in southern China because you're not ploughing it every year. So with these deeper roots that the perennial crops put down, they can get much more of their own water, they can get much more of their own nutrients, they need much less looking after than our annual crops do. And they're also more environmentally resilient. So, for instance, the Land Institute is developing a perennial sunflower at the moment to produce sunflower oil. And they have been growing their perennial sunflower alongside the ordinary annual sunflowers. They had a big drought. It completely wiped out the annual sunflowers and the perennials just sailed through it because their roots were down much deeper and their structures above ground were much tougher.
I'm glad you mentioned greenwashing in the first part of your answer because, well, with respect, you've been talking about environmental issues for decades. Mm. You know, you've been banging that drum talking about the evidence, and the evidence is clear and the evidence is stark. So what's going on? Why isn't it landing? I know, obviously, environmentalism and activism has increased in recent years, but is it a rejection of empiricism? Is it blind optimism? Is there something more sinister going on in the way that there doesn't seem to be this grand global coalition, which there probably should be, to confront this issue?
Yeah. Well, instead of getting together against our common threats, we're being set at each other, and we're just ripping each other apart on social media. We're fighting each other rather than fighting the industries which are destroying the living planet, which are destroying our life support systems. And this isn't an accident. You know, this has been fomented deliberately by greenwash capital. You know, we saw how the tobacco industries poured tens of millions of dollars into trying to persuade people that cigarette smoking was safe, that it wasn't causing lung cancer. The very same people who developed those campaigns went on to develop the fossil fuel industries campaigns. Now the same people are developing the livestock industries greenwash campaigns. And alongside them, alongside these directly funded industry lobbyists, you get all these conspiracy merchants who are basically culture war entrepreneurs and making an absolute fortune from spreading conspiracies. And what they do is they direct attention away from the real scandals, the real stuff that's going on. I mean, there are massive conspiracies happening all around us, but they're just not interested in those. The only ones they're interested in are the ones that they make up. Or they recite that other people have made up. So if you take, for instance, the VIP lane for protective equipment during the COVID pandemic, this is a massive scandal where the Conservative government conspired with its friends in business, you know, Tory donors, people in the House of Lords, all sorts of weird friends and connections. They gave them contracts to supply protective equipment during the pandemic. Many of them were completely incapable of supplying that equipment. If they did, it was often faulty. Most of it was unused. Billions were just spaffed straight into the accounts of these cronies of Tory ministers. In any other country, we call it that what it is, corruption. Straightforward corruption on a massive scale. Profiteering during a pandemic. It doesn't get much worse than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a famous film called The Third Man, which is about profiteering in a pandemic, where this evil character, Harry Lime, played by Orson Welles, is this sort of fugitive from justice, having been smoked out by providing false medical equipment, false drugs during a pandemic. And now we've got hundreds of Harry Limes running around with no one having been held to account. Not one of them is in prison. None of them have to be on the run because they haven't had their collar felt. They've just, and are the conspiracy theorists interested in this? Not a bit of it. They don't touch it. They won't even look at it. I've directly confronted a couple of them and said, why, if you're so interested in conspiracies, and this is a real one, you know, it's fully documented. Why won't you touch this? And both of them said exactly the same thing. Oh, we knew all about that already. Oh, did you? That was clever of you. So it was you who smoked this out, was it? Not the Good Law Project. Not Channel 4, not The Guardian. It was you who found this out. And you knew it all along, did you? Somehow, you just sort of intuited it, did you? You worked out who the villains were. You worked out what Matt Hancock was doing. You worked out what Rishi Sunak was doing. That's very clever of you. Yeah, brilliant. Congratulations. Shame you didn't publish it.